Great tips for summer reading. Todd Agliolaro is next. Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. Maybe on this episode we should add enjoying your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and part of the enjoyment of being Catholic, all of the beautiful books. I mean, Catholicism is a religion that loves art. We love the visual arts. We love the musical arts. And we love the art of writing. And so Todd Agliolaro, he's the director of publishing here at Catholic Answers. We invited him to come in and suggest some very fine, maybe a little lighter Catholic nonfiction for summer reading. A little lighter because summer is the time to go a little lighter. Here's what Todd had to say. Todd Agliolaro, director of Catholic Answers Publishing. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Cy, great to be here.
I think it's kind of a fun idea we have this year. We're going to do some summer reading shows, and you got the nonfiction, and you're not happy about it.
Well, I'm just a little envious, is all. My old friend Mark Brumley, I guess, is going to be doing the fiction. And when we're talking about summer reading, what comes to mind, right? It's fiction. It's the beach novel, the paperback, right, while you're relaxing in the sun and all that.
So did you, was this idea of the summer kind of type of reading in your mind when you chose these? You tried to get summery type reading?
Well, we thought about it a little bit. What is, especially when it comes to nonfiction, especially when it comes to Catholic nonfiction, what does it mean to be a summer book? Because, you know, a lot of Catholic books are serious. We publish apologetics books, popular theology, spirituality, not usually the sort of thing you think about kind of knocking down alongside a margarita under an umbrella. But I tried to think about books that that would nonetheless be sort of fitting for summertime when we're unwinding from school and work, when the air is warm and the bugs are buzzing and you're relaxed.
Okay.
And you're thinking about wanting to be delighted by what you read, not just edified.
Ah, very good.
Not just educated, but to find some delight and joy in the crafting of the words and all of that stuff. So that's
what we have here.
Yes,
have
and of course,
sampling of
it is a sampling of books that I think fit those parameters.
Okay,
and that of course also necessarily express Todd Agliolaro's personal taste. So
this
is entirely subjective, and there's probably many books here on this table that our listeners know and love as well. But I hope there'll be some new ones in there as well.
Okay, good. Well, so I'm looking here, and I actually don't know Susie Lloyd. So I get the pick, right? This is how you've set
yes,
this up.
Yes, exactly.
Get
the Those
pick,
are the rules.
And then you will tell me about that book and maybe read a sample of it for our audience and that kind of thing.
Yes.
All right, so let's start our Catholic summer reading nonfiction version with, I see this one, and I'm not familiar with it, Bless Me, Father, for I Have Kids by Susie Lloyd.
Yes. So Susie has been described as a Catholic Irma Bombeck, kind of a commonsensical every woman humorist, and she's extremely funny and a very good writer.
Okay.
Bless Me, Father, for I Have Kids is the second in a series that she wrote, kind of detailing her true and somewhat augmented stories of being a Catholic homeschool mom.
Okay.
The first one was called, I believe, Please Don't Drink the Holy Water. And it's the tales of her and her six daughters and one little boy, raising them, trying to homeschool them with all the travails that go along with it. All the trials and the tender moments and the humor unlooked for and all that sort of thing.
And she's funny?
I think she's hilarious.
That's great. Because you just don't get the funny Catholic book that much. I mean, there's not that many.
We're serious folks. We're about pain and guilt and and the cross and we embrace all that stuff. But she pulls a lot of humor out of everyday life.
Good
and though I'm not a homeschooler, I didn't have to be. I didn't have to be a homeschooler or a mom to enjoy these accounts of being a homeschooling mom.
All right, now do you want to give us a sample of Susie Lloyd? Let's hear a little bit of what she
says. I almost was able to just dip my finger in at random because
they're that good.
I think so, and of course I've set it up now and it's going to be a disappointment. But so this is a section where she's talking about homeschooling, kind of comparing it to childbirth, and then she says, take from one random example, teaching English. Being a writer, I thought that was going to be a breeze. In fact, it was the real reason I homeschooled, so that I could pass on my knowledge to my children. We started with phonics and went through an indefinite period sounding like Fred Flintstone, yabba dabba doo. At first, it was like early labor, not too painful yet, but tiring. No fear. Once you get past that early stage, you're clear to be hooked up to a workbook. That's like the epidural.
Yeah.
Your kid reads the directions, you lie back and relax a bit and let nature take its course. I recommend Catholic workbooks. That way your kid's English gets born and baptized all in one shot. For instance, penmanship, grade 1. And then she lists the words. Piety, fortitude, martyrdom, modesty, beach, attire, should, never, be, worn, to... Church.
Good for her. That's
hell.
Funny.
Damnation. Then composition hits and it starts to get tough. The transition phase has begun. So.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to get that for my wife. You know, my wife's a convert to the Catholic faith. So this is good. This will give her the light side. I love it. Very good. So that's Bless Me, Father, for I Have Kids, Susie Lloyd.
Yeah, can't recommend it highly enough.
Okay, good. All right, now I just get to randomly pick from the... Thomas Aquinas is sticking out in red and yellow here, so I'll just grab some light Thomas Aquinas reading. Really?
Well, I've got some passages here too. You want to grab one or two that I don't say? I've already broken the rules.
Oh, okay. So get some. Go a different direction.
Right. Yes.
All right.
So
I'm scared to pick now. So this I just got to see what
I'm
it
sorry,
is.
I'm sorry.
Exiles, a novel.
I
Ron
cheated.
Hansen.
I've broken two rules in the first 5 minutes.
The author of Mariette in Ecstasy. Okay.
So Ron Hansen is a Catholic novelist and screenwriter of some renown.
Yeah.
And I felt justified in choosing this so-called novel, Exiles, because it is kind of a bio novel. It's grounded in fact.
Okay.
So it's got that kind of... biographical fiction tag on it.
Okay.
That I thought was close enough.
okay.
And it tells the story set in the late 19th century during Bismarck's Kulturkampf in Germany, which is a extremely significant period for the modern world and for the church.
Right.
It might even be said that what Bismarck did then kind of birthed World Wars One and Two, and we don't look back upon him and his actions, I think, and invest those with the importance that they deserve. At any rate, as Bismarck was unifying Germany, I don't know, 1870s, 1880s, and giving it a decidedly Northern German Prussian Protestant slant, he instituted various persecutions of the church.
Okay.
And persecuted the clergy, shut churches. And this this story tells the tale of the a boat called the Deutschland, on which were five sisters. I forget what order they belonged to. They were German nuns.
Okay.
Who were essentially being exiled because of the anti-Catholic policies being instituted by Bismarck. And the ship met a sad fate. It sunk, and the sisters were all killed. He parallels his reimagining of their personal life histories with a poem that Gerard Manley Hopkins would later write about the sinking of the Deutschland.
Okay.
And weaves in the lives of the great Jesuit poet and these martyrs of a sort into a thematically unified
wow.
story. And so there's a lot of pieces there. Maybe it sounds more complicated than it is, but it's got a great unity to it, and it's just mesmerizing to read.
So it's real history.
It is.
Imagined as a novel.
So
that's right. So Hansen imagines the working off of course, what he knew of them in real life, but it gives them backstories, gives them motivations, and then
wow.
And then he works in the Hopkins part.
I got to read this. I didn't know about this at all. And I have to say, what you say about the Culture Conf, I realize I don't know that much about it. So I think this
yeah, well, you're not alone, and I certainly am no expert, but I know enough to know that we should know more.
Yeah, okay.
And this
all right. This
will dramatize for will concretize for those who read it, especially Catholics, the struggle that the Church faces in almost every era, in almost every place, that we're strangers in a hostile world, even in the heart of what was the old Holy Roman Empire, we're strangers
right.
in a hostile world.
Exiles by Ron Hansen. Okay,
yes.
Good.
Okay, I really will let you pick this time, sir.
You will?
Yes, promise.
All right, I'm going with A Severe Mercy.
Oh, come on.
Oh, come on. What the heck? All right, what am I supposed to pick?
Severe Mercy is perfect.
A Severe Mercy, okay, by Sheldon Van Auken, includes 18 previously unpublished letters by C.S. Lewis. I like that C.S. Lewis's name is way bigger than Sheldon Van Auken. You can see who sells books.
Well, this
there.
this is an early edition, I think, probably before Ignatius Press published it and made it really popular. Yeah, this is a Bantam Books edition.
Okay.
When they really had to pump up Lewis's name to give some cred. I'm probably the 50 millionth person to read and love this book, so it's
really?
This is not some gem that I've dug out of the coal.
Okay.
But it tells the story of Sheldon Van Auken, who went on to be a Catholic man of letters. But beginning in his irreligious phase and his meeting and courtship and marriage to his wife, Davy, and their mutual conversion through the Church of England and eventually to Catholicism.
Okay.
And then the personal trials and tragedies that followed that. And Van Auken is the late Sheldon Van Auken is an old friend and supporter of Catholic Answers. Carl knew him personally, and for years I carried around a little note that I stole from the Catholic Answers correspondence pile back when you corresponded via paper.
Oh yeah,
as
in
a
the
kind
olden
of
days.
Relic of the fellow. But I wish I knew where it was today. But Van Auken was a very close friend of C.S. Lewis's, and Lewis was undoubtedly an instrumental factor in bringing Van Auken to Christ. And then, you know, probably in subtle ways, leading him toward the Church.
Okay, so he made that final step, though, that Lewis himself never made.
I know.
Okay. Any thoughts on why Lewis didn't make that step? You have any?
Well, Lewis scholars could speak to that. I buy the most common explanation that he simply had too many deep-seated kind of Northern Irish biases against Catholicism to finally cross the river, but got as close as you could.
A Severe Mercy is the name of this one by Sheldon Van Auken. And you said you can get it from Ignatius Press now.
I believe Ignatius publishes its own edition, yeah.
All right, I'm going to see when on our next episode when Mark Brumley comes in.
I plugged one of his books.
Yeah, right. I want to see if he recommends any Catholic Answers books. I'm looking at your face. Can I
do it?
All right, okay, I can pick this up now. St. Thomas Aquinas, The Dumb Ox, by a little feller named G.K. Chesterton.
Not so little, but yes.
Okay, tell
in
us about that book.
Respect. So Chesterton, how do you leave him off any list of delightful Catholic nonfiction? The man was a wordsmith nonpareil. But,
right.
You know, a lot of his works can be a little effort to read. His verbal gymnastics, it's like being on a roller coaster ride of
right
nouns and verbs. Maybe the conventional choice for delightful summer reading from Chesterton would have been Orthodoxy. It's a little book,
yeah,
and it's perhaps his most accessible, perhaps leaving out his light poetry. I chose St. Thomas Aquinas, The Dumb Ox, because more than anything I've ever read, this helped me to understand St. Thomas.
Really?
And
yeah.
I was, and to no small extent still am, one of the 50 million Catholics who don't understand The Angelic Doctor as much as I ought to.
Right.
But the...
50 million?
More than that.
You're off by a power of 10 there.
We're doing our best here at Catholic Answers and others to bring him to the masses. But to me, this combines biographical anecdotes and mm-hmm. and raconteurship with Chesterton's inimical ability to break down complex ideas into common sense.
Yeah, right.
And I had two parts I wanted to read if I
might.
Oh yeah,
please do. Yeah.
One of each. So the short one is this. So I'll read the anecdote first.
Okay.
So there's this famous story of St. Thomas when he was in Paris and he had been musing about the latest resurgence of Gnosticism, the Manichaean heresy, and how to take faith and reason and unite them, how to take what our senses tell us and what our minds cogitate on and connect them. And the Manichaeans, like all Gnostics of every stripe, sought to separate those things. So Chesterton imagines it this way. Somehow they steered that reluctant bulk of reflection to a seat in the royal banquet hall, and all that we know of Thomas tells us that he was perfectly courteous to those who spoke to him, but spoke little and was soon forgotten in the most brilliant and noisy clatter in the world. The noise of French talking. What the Frenchmen were talking about, we do not know, but they forgot all about the large, fat Italian in their midst. And it seems only too possible that he had forgotten about them. Sudden silences will occur, even in French conversation. And in one of these, the interruption came. There had been no word or motion in that huge heap of black and white weeds, like motley in mourning, which marked him as a mendicant friar out of the streets and contrasted with all the colors and patterns and quarterings of that first and freshest dawn of chivalry and heraldry. The triangular shields and pennons and pointed spears, the triangular swords of the crusade, the pointed windows and the conical hoods repeated everywhere that fresh French medieval spirit that did in every sense come to the point. But the colors of the coats were gay and varied, with little to rebuke their richness, for St. Louis, who had himself a special quality of coming to the point, had said to his courtiers, "Vanity should be avoided, but every man should dress well, and in the manner of his rank, that his wife may the more easily love him." And then suddenly, the goblets leapt and rattled on the board, and the great table shook, for the friar had brought down his huge fist like a club of stone, with a crash that startled everyone like an explosion, and had cried out in a strong voice, but like a man in the grip of a dream, "And that will settle the Manichees."
Wow.
So that was the moment where St. Thomas figured out how to settle the Manichees.
Wow. Wow. But also the kind of juxtaposition of vanity and humble wisdom. And it's beautiful. That's
yes.
Beautifully done.
And then the nod to King St. Louis the Ninth.
Yes. Right. Right.
So then a much shorter passage,
which is just a little byword of mine that
I've always recalled, where he talks about what he calls the Thomistic common sense. And he says, so this is the heuristic that I've used to come back to try to grasp St. Thomas's thought. He says, "The essence of the Thomist common sense is that two agencies are at work, reality and the recognition of reality, and their meeting is a sort of marriage. Indeed, it is very truly a marriage because it is fruitful. The only philosophy now in the world that really is fruitful."
Wow.
There's reality,
yeah,
and there's the recognition of reality.
Right.
And their meeting is a sort of marriage. And that
Who but Chesterton?
Blows away Cartesianism that blows away
right.
nominalism and every ism that tries to separate our perception from what is really real.
Well, it's and Chesterton, only a modern really could write about Thomas that way, because the modern preoccupation is, how do I know what's real? I mean, how do I ever have access to what's real? Mm. That's the, it has been since Descartes, and there's Thomas saying, well, they knew how to in the Middle Ages.
Well, they knew how to in antiquity. So, of course, he has always said he baptized Aristotle and elevated Aristotelian classical realism and made it Christian.
All right. What about some books from Catholic Answers?
So yes,
there's two on the table. So this
is ours too.
Oh, okay.
Something for the kids. Well, kids through adults. In fact, the author wrote these graphic novels for adults, because I guess adults read these things.
I guess adults read these.
I'm sorry,
things.
That was a little bit
snarky.
Yeah,
the whole video department's like, well, that's what we do all the time.
I'm showing my age.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah. And they are the only apologetics graphic novels that we know of in existence in history. And they're written by a semi-cloistered abbot who goes by the pen name of Amadeus. And whose real name I won't reveal, but it is probably available for a price if you want to talk to me after the show. And he tried to marry his love of science fiction and his quirky sense of humor with apologetics and popular theology. So this is a trilogy, and the first one, The Truth Is Out There, introduces two intergalactic mailmen named Brendan and Irk, a little fellow and a big fellow, kind of in that Vladimir and Estragon tradition or Lenny and Carl tradition.
Right.
Not Lenny and Carl.
I was going to say Lenny.
From Of Mice and Men.
What's his name?
Lenny and Carl from The Simpsons. Well, forgive me.
Go ahead.
And so they have a plot that they, this kind of outer space plot. But while they're going through it, they are pursuing truth. So this book takes them and the reader through natural religion, natural law, basic philosophy, leading us to the precipice to the foundation of revelation. And then gets into Christian distinctives, and then finally Catholic distinctives. And it ends with one of the characters being baptized into the church. The second is the sequel to The Truth Is Out There. It's called The Big Picture. And it backs up, and it follows the further development of the faith life of these two characters, set against a parallel exposition of salvation history. From Eden to Calvary, and it's the most ambitious of the three in that the main plot, which is a kind of a sci-fi thriller story, has thematic interweavings with the themes of salvation history, and then finally The Weapons of War, which refers to the sacraments, is probably the darkest and most serious of the three. And it takes up it recalls modern themes of persecution of the church, religious freedom, and morality, and how the sacraments are the weapons that we have, the swords of the spirit, to fight the world, the flesh, and the devil.
So I envision maybe a parent with some teenagers or younger this summer just getting these. Leaving them out on the coffee table.
Yeah.
Let the kids discover them themselves.
They're colorful. They're funny. I wish reading from them really wouldn't do justice, because being graphic novels,
yeah,
half of the experience is in the visual.
Right.
But Father Amadeus is a really funny guy. And though they were written for adults, my kids started picking them up at 11 or 12.
Uh-huh.
We found that confirmation age, or at least what's confirmation age in most areas, that 14, 15 range seems to be where they really grab
Perfect.
On. And they're faith building too.
Yeah, and they will pick them up. It's because they've got pictures.
Yeah,
at some point they're going to pick them up. I'm bored, Mom. Yeah. Well, look on the table, George. It's Lenny and George.
Lenny and George, thank you.
All right, I'm going to save Mr. Belloc for the end. So let's go with Edmund Campion. I assume it's not by Edmund Campion.
It is not. We have very little of what Edmund Campion wrote other than his so-called brag. But yes, this is by Evelyn Waugh, and who was also primarily a writer of fiction.
Yeah.
Perhaps best known among Catholics for his masterpiece, Brideshead Revisited.
I thought you were going to say Helena. Best known for Helena, but maybe not. No, I'm just teasing you.
Campion, as Edmund Campion, is kind of an analog to Helena in that it's a historical imagining of in much the same way that Exiles was, though it's less of a novel in its construction. But it tells the story of St. Edmund Campion, who was an Elizabethan martyr, perhaps the greatest and most talented of them all, though maybe not the most accomplished because of the early end that he met. But he was one of the greatest men of his time. In fact, none other than Queen Elizabeth II herself called him the Jewel of England.
Yeah.
Such was his learning and brilliance. But like many who went on to be martyrs in that era, he did not yield to the new religion.
Right.
And went to the continent, became a Jesuit, and returned and was one of these priests who made the rounds at the old Catholic houses, the little recusant homes, and hid in the priest holes and said mass in the hidden attic chapels.
Amazing.
If you've ever gotten to visit those homes, it really is quite extraordinary. I was able to once by the good graces of an English priest friend. And it's every bit, I mean, these little tiny cubbies that they would stuff them in were every bit as cramped and dark and scary as you can imagine, and the hidden chapels, and was caught out, probably betrayed, and went to hang at Tyburn Tree, the immense gallows that was constructed in northern London, hanged and drawn and quartered in that way that non-squeamish ages of the past consider to be a fitting punishment
right,
for
when
heretics.
The whole world was like a Mel Gibson movie.
That's right. Whether he cried freedom at the end, I don't know. But and Waugh is a wordsmith of the first order.
Boy, is he.
And you know, knew how to wield the pen.
All right, Edmund Campion.
His rousing account of
if you went to a Catholic university, there's an Edmund Campion Hall somewhere on the campus, but you don't know the man, get the book. Evelyn Waugh, Edmund Campion. But you can also recommend almost anything from Waugh.
Yes, indeed.
And here's another one that you can recommend almost anything from, but you'd spend a lifetime if you wanted to read it all. How many books?
Something like 150 books Hilaire Belloc wrote, yeah.
All right, so you chose The Path to Rome.
They used to tease Belloc about how prolific he was, and some of his books he didn't, shall we say, put a lot of care into the research of.
Oh,
and he used to say, I have to write so many books because I need the money because my children are howling for pearls and caviar, he used to say. So he'd blame it on his kids. But really, it was just his own lifestyle, I think. But yes, there was no way I was going to leave this out. It's one of my favorite books, and I never fail to recommend it if you give me the time. The Path to Rome, which was also, Belloc himself said, the only book he ever wrote for love.
Really?
Every other book of the 150 some odd that he ever wrote, including ones that his light verse books like The Bad Child's Book of Beasts, or his two other very famous travel books, The Four Men and The Cruise of the Nona, which are beloved, or his historical works, all of them he said, I wrote for money.
But not this.
Not The Path to Rome. So The Path to Rome was written, I believe, in 1902. When he was still a relatively young and unbroken man. And he conceived of the idea of walking from the city of Toul in central southern France to Rome. Belloc was renowned for his feats of physical prowess. He was a tramper.
Yeah.
And he thought nothing of walking 30, 40 miles a day.
Wow.
Around his home of Sussex or around the continent. And so he conceived of this idea of just of walking through Catholic Europe and writing down whatever occurred to him along the way and drawing pictures because he was also an accomplished artist. And so that's what he does. And what emerges is a really unique book. Now, there are other travelogue-type books, one that our Father Hugh recommended that I've been reading called A Time of Gifts by Patrick Lefermer is another example of this genre that I would recommend. And that was a walk from Amsterdam to Constantinople, so an even greater feat than what Belloc did. But it's more than that. It's a love song to Catholic Europe before all was shattered by the two world wars.
Yeah.
And then Belloc would, in fact, write a foreword to a later edition after the both world wars, after he lost his wife and two of his sons prematurely. And he spent his life, and then he had a stroke and kind of spent his life in diminished capacities and in constant mourning for them. But he said, what I have written about in this book no longer exists. Yeah. So it's kind of a time capsule.
Wow.
Now, is it a little bit gauzy? Is it a little bit idealized for those of us, especially New Worlders like we, who want to, who have this romantic picture of Catholic Europe? Probably. And Belloc was known to be an exaggerator and that sort of thing. But it doesn't diminish in any way how delightful it is to read.
It makes it a good summer read.
Makes it a good summer read. So if we have the time,
Please give us a passage. Yes.
We're probably nearing the end. So this is another book that I could have put a blindfold on and picked a page at random. But this is one of the better-known stories. So he made a couple of vows before setting out, one of which is that he would, as he put it, hear Mass every day. He would end Mass every day. And that he would go on foot the entire way. So he was suffering from a cramp or something. He was tired. He was about halfway through. And he was drawing, and he said, my fatigue was very great and my walking painful to an extreme. And then he came up on a gorge and he begins to sketch. And he says, while I was occupied sketching the slabs of limestone, I heard wheels coming up behind me and a boy on a wagon stopped and hailed me. What the boy wanted to know was whether I would like a lift. And this he said in such curious French that I shuddered to think how far I had pierced into the heart of the hills and how soon I might come to quite strange people. I was greatly tempted to get into his cart, but though I had broken so many of my vows, one remained yet whole and sound, which was that I would ride upon no wheeled thing. Remembering this, therefore, and considering that the faith is rich in interpretation, I clung on to the wagon in such a manner that it did all my work for me and yet could not be said to be actually carrying me. Distinguo. The essence of a vow is its literal meaning. The spirit and intention are for the major morality and concern natural religion. But when upon a point of ritual or of dedication or special worship, a man talks to you of the spirit and intention and complains of the dryness of the word, look at him askance. He is not far removed from heresy.
That's Belloc. How beautiful. How wonderful. Well, Todd, I'm very, very grateful to you for these. And we'll put the list up maybe on our, we'll put it on the Facebook page, the list of the various books.
And we have our own beautiful edition of The Path to Rome. I think we have some copies left.
So you can get that at shop.catholic.com as well. But say a word about why read some books this summer. Why just pick up the printed page and read some?
Oh, I wish I had something profound for you. Reading keeps the brain working.
Yeah, amen.
And it renews us. And especially if like a lot of us and probably a lot of your listeners, we're always reading to be edified, to be bettered. That can be work.
Yeah.
And sometimes we need to read just to rest in the beauty of expression. And really, that's a foretaste of heaven, isn't it?
It is indeed. Thanks, Todd. Thank you very, very much.
That's great.
Have a happy summer. Well, I've got my reading cut out for me this summer because I'm realizing, now that I've spoken to Todd about it, I haven't read very many of those books that are on his list. So that's maybe a bad thing in that I haven't done it, but a good thing in that I've got it all to look forward to. I hope you have it to look forward to as well. Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to support what we do here, we do need your support. You can do that at givecatholic.com. Just leave a little note, whatever you're giving, whether it's $5 or $5 billion. A little note that says this is for Catholic Answers Focus. We'll get the money to the right place. If you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe. Please do. That helps us grow on YouTube. And if you're listening, wherever you're listening, subscribe. That way you'll get an update whenever a new episode is available. Also, please give us that 5-star review. Maybe write something about what you get out of the program. That helps to grow the program as well. I'm Cy Keller, your host. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.